technology, wisdom people. So, again, we've begun with prayer. We have reminded ourselves that we are starting with the story of Isaac because we did not finish. We're starting with the story of Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac, which is perfect because it is the story of Isaac that we're going to look at today. And we need to understand what has been going on beforehand. That is that that Abraham has been being molded, and God has taken his fear and molded it into trust. But in that trust, he also has to mature that trust into being trustworthy. And so what we've seen in Abraham's story is that Abraham has learned to be trustworthy with others, Sarah, and then with Abimelech and others that are within the country of Canaan. So now God says to Abraham, well, there's one more partnership that you need to see whether you can be trustworthy or not, and that is the partnership with me. And that's why we have the sacrifice of Isaac. So we have in Genesis 22 the possibility of fear provoked. Remember, this is how he's going to bring Abraham to a trustworthy character, and that is provoking his fear and then offering belonging. So the possibility of fear being provoked is actually to see whether his fear is being ordered or disordered. And so God calls Abraham, and Abraham immediately answers, here I am. So good start, right? Great, God answers and he calls, here I am. Basically, he says to Abraham, I want to do a little more molding, Abraham. And Abraham is like, great, go ahead. This is what ordered fear looks like. When God calls us to be molded and he says, I'm going to provoke your fear, and you say, okay. So this morning, I felt like God wanted to provoke my disappointment, and I was not quite sure I wanted to say okay. So ordered emotions will immediately go, okay, I'm fearful, I'm going to move toward God immediately, rather than, what can I do about this? How can I get rid of it?
Which I would think is so A&E.
Right.
How can we appease him?
Right, exactly. Right. So, the actions then that God calls Abraham to, Abraham sacrificed your son, would only be undertaken if Abraham is absolutely certain about God's trustworthiness. He absolutely is certain, otherwise he wouldn't undertake it, right? First of all, one of the things we need to know is he doesn't evaluate the call to sacrifice his son as an immoral action. In the A&E, gods were who provided things were entitled to demand a portion of whatever they provided. So if they provided fertility, they were entitled to actually have a portion of that, and that would be a child. If they provided animals, crops, grains, they would be entitled to a portion of that. So in the A&E world, a god asking for the sacrifice of your child was not unusual. So for Abraham, he's not going, what? Why would you have me do that? As far as an immoral action. In the A&E world, it wouldn't be considered immoral. The request, therefore, isn't, it's not baffling to Abraham, except that it's connected to the covenant, right? This is the way you're going to produce covenant, your promise. That is concerning. But again, within the molding process for Abraham, Abraham has seen God be trustworthy over and over and over again. And he understands that nothing is impossible with God, even, as we know in the New Testament, Abraham even thinks, well, God could resurrect, because he's resurrected something that was dead before, and that's Sarah's womb. He's already done that. So Abraham, at this point in his life, has no qualms about him, if that's how the picture is going to be, resurrecting Isaac. That's why he's able to go forth with it. He completely trusts that God is going to have something good here. He also doesn't assume that the test is meant to break him. He's had enough experiences with God's molding to be able to trust that even in his further molding, it's not going to break him. He understands at some level that the test is actually going to make him more effective in his partnering, because that's what God has been working on, right? Is his partnering skills, able to partner with the other being Sarah, then the other being Abimelech, and now the great other being with God. So a test, as opposed to a temptation, tests a quality of someone by stretching it to its limits. Think about the commercials that we've seen where car manufacturers test their cars to the limit, right? They crash them, they open doors back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, until they stretch it to its limit to see, will it be able to withstand whatever the world is going to give it, whatever is going to come at it, right? That's the whole idea. Will you be able to withstand what the world will call you to in your partnership with me? Will that partnership remain effective there? That's why the product that we, the United States has a huge amount of legal necessities of tests so that we know that it's going to be effective. What's with the vaccine? I mean, it took a shorter time than normal, but the normal process of doing a vaccine is testing it over and over and over again to see that it's going to be effective. That's what is happening here. So, and Abraham, in some extent, knows that that's what's happening. His willingness also is not a matter of a reaction. It's not a knee-jerk reaction. That's the whole purpose of the three-day journey. A three-day journey means it's not just an emotional reaction. It's not just, oh, I've got to do this because that's what God's wanting me to do. It is 3 days to make sure that his body, his mind, and his emotions are all integrated. 3 days, think about 3 days. He's got 3 days to think about, is this really what God's saying for me to do? Is this a good idea? To integrate it, remember our slow thinking, our analytical thinking, is meant to evaluate the reality of our emotions. And so he has 3 days in order to do that. And so it confirms that the movement toward doing this is exactly in the realm of God's request. Yes, he thoroughly understands that this call is good. And the reason we know for sure that he knows this call is good is that he builds an altar. Remember, up until now, every time he builds an altar, it is a time when he's seen God and it's been a good thing. So an altar is always a memorial to say, this was a good thing. And so here, Abraham, that's what he does. He goes and he builds an altar. Yes, this is a good thing. It's done with his whole being, very integrated together. And he's confident enough to say to his servants, we will come back. We, both Isaac and I, will come back. So he's confident of that. So, stretching Abraham's character, what's the character, what's the quality that's being stretched to its limit? It's the trustworthiness of relationship with God in his partnership. In other words, is your trustworthiness only in operation because you're getting a benefit from this partnership? The motivation for participation in the partnership. What is your motivation, Abraham? Is it your gain that you're getting from this, or is it love? Is it literally wanting to be in partnership with me, or is it because out of the partnership you're going to get something? You're going to get land, you're going to get descendants, you're going to get vocation. That's what is being tested here. What's the motivation for you being in partnership with me? The function of the test is to strengthen Abraham's faith. His trust and his trustworthiness will be able to withstand whatever the world assaults him with. And it grounds the covenant in mutual trustworthy participation. Not only God is the trustworthy partner, but Abraham as well. And so we have this idea that the function is to strengthen Abraham's faith. But the purpose, and this is one of those, really? The purpose is done for God's benefit. He says, so I can know. Now, when we talk about knowledge with God, it's not information knowledge. It's not so that I know it. It's experiential knowledge. So that word know here in Hebrew can mean either one. And here he's meaning so that I can experience your attachment to me. Not knowledge of your attachment, but experience it. God desires for all of us to act out our faith, regardless of the fact that he knows our heart. He knows our heart. He wants us to act it out so he can experience it. Think about this. your husband, your mother, your father says they love you. Great, I know you love me, but boy, do I love it when you act it out. The experience does something different than pure knowledge, right? And that's what actually God is going to gain from that. God receives pleasure from Abraham's demonstration of trust. He receives pleasure. And we know throughout Scripture that God can be pleased. And this is what pleases him. When Abraham left his country and when he left his family, there was something in it for him, right? God said, I'm going to replace that. I'm going to replace that with a land of your own. I'm going to replace that with a family of your own. Here, when he asks him to sacrifice Isaac, there's no promise connected to it. He doesn't say, do this and I will give you something. He just says, do it. God is asking Abraham to give up the promises to fill the vacated areas, which is what Isaac embodies, right? All the promises. Give those promises up. And he poses the question, if I give you nothing but myself, will that be enough to fill you? If I give you nothing but myself, will that be enough to fill you? So the focal point of the text is not the danger to Isaac. It is the danger to Abraham's relationship with God. Will it remain stagnant, focused on benefits, or will it be transformed and matured into a mutually trustworthy relationship, partnership? So, we know that when God provokes fear, he also offers belonging. We understand that ordered fear moves toward God in scary situations. Knowing his presence is all I need. And that pleases God. This is the ordered fear, this pleasure that God gives God the experience of being loved, the experience of belonging. We get to offer that to God. What an amazing thing that we can offer that to God. God provides through the provision of the ram. Abraham gets to expand the revelation of who God is. Now he gets to see God in a bigger way because he is absolutely giving himself to God. Yes, yes, God, you are enough. That's what his putting Isaac on the altar says. You are enough. And he finds then that the Lord provides even in this. And we have the ram. And because of the ram, Abraham names that place, the Lord will provide, Yahweh Jireh. By naming the place Yahweh Jireh, it extends the meaning of the name he had previously in the previous two chapters, and that was El Olam, God, the everlasting God. Remember, the everlasting God talked about God being able to look over and see to the history and destiny of his people. So big, long-term overseeing, right? Here with the ram, God is saying, I don't just oversee the big stuff. I oversee the little stuff. I oversee the short-term needs. I will see to the details of the immediate and the personal. So we know that the A&E gods, there were lots of gods, right? And they considered the fact that some of the gods had oversight over some of the big stuff, over weather, over nations winning wars, over crops. But there were other gods that had oversight over the little stuff, over personal health, over daily food, over safety. What's happening here is that God's revelation of himself, not only is El Olam, the God who oversees the long-term stuff, and the God who provide, Yahweh Jireh, God is the sole God to worship. There are no other gods existing. In other words, he's not just a replacement for a personal God. This is a huge transition for Abraham. Oh, this Yahweh isn't just a personal God that has come to me. He's filling the roles of all the gods. It is the first time we have any indication of the patriarchs beginning to understand monotheism. This is shattering to the A&E world. What?
only one God, this is the first time we have a beginning understanding of that. It will take all throughout the patriarchs to get to a solid idea of monotheism. But that's what's happening here with Isaac's sacrifice and Abraham being able to see, oh, you're a God who looks over the long term and the short term personal needs. Oh, you do all of the jobs of the gods. So what he gives then Abraham in this opportunity is he gives him the benefit of the gift of being able to participate with him in the covenant as a partner. Yes, I'm enough for you. Yes, we can partner together. And actually, you and your descendants now are not looking, will not only look for the benefits for themselves. In fact, the benefits aren't for you. The benefits of the covenant are so that you can do the job to give them to others. That's a huge deal, right? Because if the benefit is why we're in the partnership, then we will very unlikely give that benefit out. That's what the whole thing is about, right? I'm going to hoard it. I'm not going to easily give it away to others. I'm going to be more concerned about keeping it for myself. And I'm also not likely to let God work through me because all I want is that benefit. What God is doing with Abraham is showing him it's not the benefits you're in the partnership for. And now that you're not in the partnership for the benefits, as I give you the benefits, they're going to be for others. Now they can flow through you. Now you're actually a vehicle for which my benefits can flow through you rather than get stopped up with you. Does that make sense? That's exactly why we have the story of Isaac's sacrifice. Now, of course, lots of things in there. I'm not giving you everything, but enough for us to understand what God is doing here with Abraham. So, remembering then that the molding process for Abraham and for us is not meant to help us discover what are the attachments that are obstacles for us. That's not the meaning of a test. It's actually to help us discover what is our motivation for our relationship with God. Is it so that we get the benefits? Or is it so that we actually have a relationship with God? Is that enough? I'm not here, God says, to provide you with the things to fill your picture. I'm going to supply you with myself. And you need to know that I'm going to be enough in order for you to be able to fulfill your vocation. So that's the end of lesson 2, and we'll go into then lesson 3. With just a really quick review of where we've been so far. So we began understanding that all of the Genesis 12 through 50 is teaching us that God's work needs to be paid attention to, not just his presence, which is what we learned in Genesis 1 through 11, pay attention to God's presence, but now we learn pay attention to God's work, because God's work is transforming us from a disordered character into his character. So it's transforming us. I told you that I would have calligraphy prints for each of these. And so for this first section, I have a calligraphy thing that talks about God transforming. It is from Romans 12, of course. And I'll just read the middle part that, can we see that here? Let God transform you into a new person by changing the way you think. That's out of Romans 12, and that's how Timothy Botts shows it. And what it has are, these are different hands over here, and God transforming those hands into a beautiful picture, right? So that's the idea that we have of this first part of the patriarch's story. We talked about in lesson 1, paying attention to his faithful molding, so that he will mold us from fear to trust. And he does that by provoking our emotions and then offering us a sense of belonging. In lesson 2, we talked about his faithful partnership in molding from trusting to trustworthiness. And so that's why we have the T here, right?
molding us from fear to trust, and then maturing that trust into trustworthiness. That's where we've been so far in Genesis. Today, we will begin understanding that God, in God's sovereignty, remember, this is his faithfulness to mold our fear into trust and mature it into trustworthiness. Now we'll see God's sovereignty molding us from disappointment. So we'll put up a D for disappointment here. Something I think that we all, this is going to be one of those days. Disappointment is what is the emotion that he's going to provoke. And he's going to provoke it in Isaac and us as well. And he's going to provoke that disappointment and change that disappointment, transform that disappointment. And so as we look at the molding of Isaac, as he's going to transform his disappointment, we need to just quickly review again the disordered emotions of self-focused people, which is how we started in our introduction. Remember, self-focused people will be fearful. And because they're fearful, they're going to scramble for self-protection. They'll also be easily disappointed. And that's where we are with Isaac. And easily disappointed people scramble to find ways to satisfy themselves. Next week, we'll look at the anxious posturing position of Jacob. So this week, disappointment with Isaac. Now, let's define disappointment and just kind of briefly look at what disappointment looks like in our life. So, disappointment is the displeasure or the dissatisfaction caused by the non-fulfillment of one's hopes or expectations. Let me say that again. It is the displeasure or dissatisfaction caused by the non-fulfillment of one's hopes or expectations. All of us have hopes and expectations. All of us have pictures that we paint. If I ask you to paint yourself a picture right now of what your life will look like, whether it's in your marriage status or your child status or your job status, whatever it is, we have a picture that we paint. We have these hopes and we have these expectations. And when those hopes and expectations are not fulfilled, we become dissatisfied and disappointed. The issue, though, is not the circumstances, because things will happen in all of our lives that are out of our control that we don't want to happen. The issue is disordered disappointment. The issue in disordered disappointment is our hopes and our expectations. In other words, the pictures we paint of our future are too often painted only by our desires. When we set those pictures in stone, they become the standard by which we judge what is good. This is what is good. I have in my head, this is what is good. This morning, this is what is good. It will be warm in here. All the technology will go well. The lesson will not go over, and it will go over, I can assure you. All of that I painted this morning. And of course, immediately, because I'm teaching this lesson, God says, you know, I'm going to disappoint you. I'm going to provoke your disappointment here because I want you to understand that you're not, the good way of living is not going towards your own picture because you don't know everything. You cannot possibly paint a picture that is a standard of good. And so, disappointment then is a matter of shame. I'm not able to make my picture happen. I'm not able to produce what I see as good. But remember, we've learned this long time ago, shame is a good thing. It's our brain's warning that we're going in the wrong direction. It's like the railroad crossing gate, bringing it down. Hey, hey, don't go there, don't go there. You're moving in the wrong direction. That's what shame is meant to do. So that when I come up against disappointment, an ordered disappointment,
would move me toward God's picture of good. And his picture of good is always his presence is enough, and his work that he's doing right now is good. Just like fear, an ordered fear moves us toward God. A disordered fear moves us toward constructing our own protection. Ordered disappointment moves us toward God. Disordered disappointment moves us toward constructing our own soothing. How can I feel better? I don't like this feeling. I want to feel better. Paul tells us in Romans that those who hope in the Lord will not be disappointed. But notice, you're not disappointed only when your picture is the Lord, not when your picture is anything else. So, let's look at what happens when we paint our own picture and how disappointment digresses. Painting our own picture is painting a picture of reality. This is what we say is good. What is good, though, always is defined by our feelings or what we think is right. It's narrowing our sight. It's seeing life only from my perspective. It's saying, I know enough about life that I can say this is good. And even if you have been a Christian for years and years and you know everything there is to know about God, impossible, right? But you believe that, and you, well, this is a picture because this coordinates with what God says. Even that says, I know what God is saying and doing here. So even if you think your picture is a godly picture, you're already setting yourself up to say, I know everything there is to know about God and how God works. And the problem is that it also says, not only do I know what reality is, but I know who God is. And yet we have a disordered understanding of what it means for God to be who he is. In fact, we have the same kind of problem about knowing God than the A&E people did. We believe God is provider. Well, isn't that what we just learned out of Isaac's sacrifice, that God is provider? The problem is we see God as merely provider, that his power to faithfully provide for me is the only aspect of his wisdom. Right? God is provider. He's going to provide for me. And the problem is I've painted a picture, and then I've said God is just provider. And I put those two together and I say, well, God is going to see to it to providing all the elements that are needed to fulfill my picture. You see what happens? I begin to narrow God, not just my view of reality, but also narrow God. And so when some aspect of my picture is disrupted, I will move toward satisfying or soothing myself in order to avoid being disappointed again. So that's diversion. So it goes from painting my own picture of reality and of who God is to diversion, to a soothing mechanism. Just as disordered fear moves to a protective scheme, disordered disappointment will move me toward a soothing scheme. The soothing scheme will be a movement towards something for the purpose of indulging my sensual cravings. Some activity that makes me feel soothed, that makes me feel comfortable, and in the process allows me to turn a blind eye to the event or the person that disrupted my picture. Does that make sense? So it's not merely this gives me pleasure. It allows me to feel comfortable and avoid the person or the disruption of my picture. I don't really want to deal with the disruption of my picture. I don't really want to throw it away. So if we had time, I was going to have you actually all paint a little picture and then go and take it from you and rip it up. You would hate that. No matter how bad your picture was, you would not like that. You would want to say, well, let me throw it away maybe. But no, this idea of changing my picture, I don't want to see that. I don't want that to happen. So a soothing activity is employed for its soothing effects, but it manipulates the activity to meet an unintended, a self-focused purpose, which will move me away from God's presence and his work, right? Because his whole idea of provoking our disappointment is to work us, to mold us. So things like eating or drinking may be a soothing activity for me if I'm not doing it for its intended purpose. Why am I eating and drinking? What's the real purpose of eating and drinking?
Staying alive.
Staying alive, to nourish, right? But if I'm doing it for another reason other than nourishing, I need to question, am I doing it to soothe myself because my picture is being disrupted? And I don't want to think about that. I just want to think about being comfortable. All the things we do can be manipulated and used for their unintended purposes, right? Media, exercise, sex, thinking even can be manipulated instead of meant to discern reality and tell the truth. Thinking can be manipulated to compartmentalize and not think about what is being happening. Working, shopping, all of you know all the soothing types of activities that can happen. So when I am in painting my own picture and then diverting myself, creating some kind of soothing scheme, what happens if I don't catch it is that it will move from there to then being easily offended. Because a movement towards self-serving, towards self-soothing, avoids dealing with the emotion, which means I'm going to be further agitated when my disappointment is made evident again, usually by someone inadvertently exposing it. And all of a sudden, they expose it, and you're more agitated than before. I then must push them away, and I usually do that by blaming them. Because I feel like they're implicitly suggesting that I haven't fulfilled my picture, or my picture isn't a good one, because they've brought that up. In some, they didn't mean to push my buttons, but all of a sudden I'm offended. And in fact, I remember a study that was so good for me that reminded me, as believers, there really should never be a time when we're personally offended. If our whole life is wrapped up in being a partner with God, there's no reason to be offended. But we paint our own pictures, we try to self-soothe, and then someone exposes the fact that we're self-soothing, and we're offended. It's a defensive move, and it's often displayed by anger, sometimes internal anger, sometimes external anger. Basically, how dare you imply I'm a failure? That's what happens to self-soothing as it becomes deeper and deeper in your life, and then someone touches on that to expose that and actually makes you feel as if you're a failure. So let me give you an example. Most of you know that for about 13, 14 years, I have not had a relationship with my dad. He disowned me and my sister. And so, of course, I had to create a picture about that. Well, what's the picture I created? Of course, my picture is reconciliation, right? That's a good picture. Mm-hmm. And I keep saying, that seems like God's picture, right? So here's my picture. And because this is the picture I had, I worked toward that. I would invite him, or I would call him, or I would offer help, and it was always denied, always denied, always denied. And my self-soothing activity was always to compartmentalize. So I always do it in thinking, and I compartmentalize. And I compartmentalize by not thinking about that. Okay, he declined again, put that aside. Let's just live life. Let's not think about that. Let's not actually encounter that disappointment and talk to God about it. It's just, okay, put that aside and just keep going. I did what I was supposed to do, and now keep going. But then my dad ends up dying. So he died in the summer. I had 2 weeks before called him again asking, what can I do? Nothing, didn't want to talk. And then he dies. And my picture is shattered, right? My picture was always for reconciliation. what's going on? It's shattered. And I've been self-soothing myself throughout 13 years of, I'm sure it's going to happen. I'm sure it's going to happen. And it doesn't. And now there's no way for it to happen. That will not happen. That was not God's picture, which seems odd to me, right? Mm-hmm. But here's what happens later. I had contacted an ex-brother-in-law who had been married to the sister who actually instigated this split. But he had been close to my dad, and I figured he probably wouldn't know, so I texted him that my dad had died. He proceeded to text me throughout the night horrible accusations about how I had never attempted to reconcile with my dad, what a shameful person I was, he would be praying for me. This, and what happened? I was deeply offended. I was so offended, even speaking to you now, it's just like, what? You know nothing. And I'm riling through this, and I recognize, okay, I need to go back to God. I need to ask him about this. God, is this your picture? Is this my picture? What's going on? And so I did. I said, God, did I not do enough to reconcile with my dad? Did I not offer enough times? Did I not give enough invitations? Clearly, very clearly, God said to me, you did enough. You gave the invitations. This was his choice. This was the picture I was giving you. There was a pause from what I heard, and then he said, but you never attempted to reconcile with your sister. It was always about your dad, and my picture has always been that you reconcile with your sister. And it was, oh, God gave me another picture that I didn't even recognize because I was so invested in my own picture. And so that's kind of the example. Now, I will tell you that a month ago, for the first time in 13 years, all four of us sisters got together. And so that picture is beginning to bring fruition. Now, as you know, it's going to be a long time coming. But I recognize that I had been so invested in my own picture, I never even saw God's picture. His picture all along was a reconciliation of sisters. So, what are the dangers of self-soothing? It interferes with new learning and development. This is what psychologists tell us. When you continue to self-soothe, you will stop learning and you will stop developing, which is exactly what God is telling us with the patriarchs. I'm trying to mature you into my character. You continue to self-soothe and you are not going to develop. Secondly, it impairs your most important relationships. Obviously, that is exactly what has happened here. And when it impairs your most important relationship, it undermines your support system. You no longer have that support system, that cheerleading section. And because you don't have that cheerleading section, you are more likely to turn again to self-soothing methods. Mm-hmm. And so the self-soothing methods is what already can't give you complications in your relationships in the first place, so it'll just get worse. It's a spiral that goes down. So that when I regularly employ self-soothing schemes, it often ends up enslaving me in dependency, in addictions to those self-soothing, so that now I can't even identify the ways that I self-soothe. So how is God going to use that in his pattern of work with Isaac? Well, he's going to do the same as he did with Abraham. He's going to provoke Isaac's disappointments. He's going to throw Isaac's picture out of kilter. He's going to get Isaac moving. And he's going to expose the self-soothing schemes as empty, that they do not actually get him maturity. They don't move him toward maturity. And in that, remember for Abraham, he provoked his fear, and then he gave him a sense of belonging. With Isaac, he's going to give him a new picture. You're so invested in your picture, I'm going to provoke your disappointment, and then I'm going to give you a new picture. In order to experience God's sovereignty is good. When we talk about God's sovereignty, what we mean is that God is the one and the only one who can paint a picture of reality. He's the only one that knows everything and can so determine it. Not only determine what the picture is, but how to fulfill it. So he'll offer Isaac a new picture so that Isaac will turn from his own picture, which has caused him to move toward his self-soothing schemes, to expectancy of what good God's picture is. So we had Abraham learning to trust, and we're going to have Isaac learning to be expectant of good. So we have an E there. So expectancy of good, that whatever God brings is going to be the good. That's where God is molding Isaac. So we get to then the molding opportunities. And we get to Genesis 22 and on. Before he actually begins to mold him in expectancy of good, he's going to give him a faithful foundation. We've already seen some of that foundation. Let's just review a little bit of it. The faithful foundation that God gives Isaac is his work in Isaac's dad's life, right? In Abraham's life. God passes that on to Isaac. He passes on the fact that his presence and his work in Abraham's life actually brings Abraham to a different character. It molds him differently. Isaac was able to experience a lot of that firsthand. Now, not all of it that he first molded Abraham in, but much of it. Abraham is still on the scene as we talk about Isaac in 23 and on. So we see in Genesis 22 that Abraham responded to the sacrifice request, and by his response, we find that God is able to provide for the immediate and the personal needs. We see Abraham responding to Sarah's death in 23. So Sarah dies, and what we still see is that Abraham had a faithful partnership with Sarah, right? And so he mourns Sarah. But notice, Sarah, his trustworthy partner, he mourns, but then it says, and Sarah died in the land of Canaan, and Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Then Abraham rose from before the dead and spoke to the sons of Heth. He mourned, but then he got up and he continued to move with God toward a covenant action. So he mourns him, but he doesn't allow the mourning to deter him from continuing to move with God. And what we see here next is his continual partnership with God is the way he partners with other people. Now he's going to partner with the sons of Heth. He negotiates for a burial plot for Sarah. And the negotiations reveal a lot about Abraham. It reveals that the sons of Heth see Abraham, as it says in 23, as a mighty prince among us. Okay, that's huge. Not a mighty prince over there against us. A mighty prince among us. They see a trustworthy partnership in Abraham because of the character he has displayed with them. That's all the text has to tell us. They admire him and they see him as trustworthy. None, Ephron says, none would refuse you a place to bury your wife. They honor him. They see him not as a threat. They're not afraid of him. They're honoring him. And then we have this willingness to sell land. Now remember, arable land is very precious in the Middle East. So precious that owners would rarely sell it to anyone outside of their kinship group. As an alien and a stranger, Abraham actually has no legal right to buy land. But Abraham really doesn't want to buy land. He only wants to buy a burial plot. Think about a cemetery today. You actually buy a plot, right? But you don't own the land. You don't own the cemetery. You own the plot. And actually, you really just, there's nothing you can do on the plot. It's just to bury. There's not, you can't go there and, although I have seen some you people plant little plot. Gardens. You can plant a garden.
Plant a tree.
You can't plant food to produce your, you know, for your family. So, that's all Abraham wants. And yet, even that is a big deal in the Middle East. Abraham, though, in asking that, doesn't want to take advantage of them. He offers to buy it for full price, and he refuses it as a gift. But notice the negotiations here are on both sides very respectful. He doesn't say, absolutely, you're not gonna give this to me. I'm buying it. Who do you think you are? No. Please watch the language there. It's beautiful, and it really shows how Abraham has great respect for the sons of Heth, as they do for him. Why does he want to buy it instead of receiving it as a gift? Well, a couple reasons. First of all, it ensures that the partnership between Abraham and the sons of Heth isn't confused with who will truly give the land to Abraham. It isn't that some of the Philistines gave him land and God gave him other. No, nobody's going to give him land but God. If the land is a gift, Ephraim, the heirs of Ephraim, can actually take it back once Ephraim dies. If it's bought at a discounted price, it could later be connected to any family debt problems that Ephraim's family has, and therefore allow the heirs to reclaim it. So Abram is assuring that the burial plot will always be his. So his partnership with the sons of Heth is, again, an amazingly trustworthy partnership. He is not doing it disrespectfully, and he's not making an enemy by doing this. He's making sure that he doesn't. But he's also partnering with God. He's creating an attachment to the land for his family. With the family matriarch being buried here, the descendants now have an important connection to the land. But he doesn't take the land. He's still waiting for God to give it. A burial plot doesn't give him the claim for a livable or farmable land. He doesn't have land. He has a burial plot. So we see in Abraham's willingness to do this, his willingness is not to just be a passive receiver, but to honor God's picture with his actions. I'm not going to get land. I'm not going to buy land. I'm going to get a plot so that we remain connected. And you'll see that a little farther on. So we have, this is all things that Isaac has seen, right? We have Abraham's concubines. So in Genesis 25, we notice that Abraham marries Keturah. Lots of theological discussion when that marriage happens. Probably not right now, probably beforehand. But notice, and here's the reason that the text mentions it. The children of those concubines never become rivals for the covenant promises. Why? Because Abraham gives all of his inheritance to Isaac. And he sends all the other sons away. Away from Isaac, eastward, east with gifts, right?
Yeah.
All of them have no claims on what Isaac is given. And none of them go away without gifts. So Abraham is partnering with God in the covenant. Yes, God, you have said that Isaac is that. I will not allow any of my sons to interfere in that.
But when he sends them east, is that a sign? Like, he's still in connection with
us. He's still in connection. And remember, sending east means you are not in the covenant line, but you will be blessed because you have a connection with me.
Okay.
So you don't, there's no cutting off of connection, but they will be blessed. They will have their own nations, every one of them, because they've been connected to Abraham. So again, just like Hagar with Ishmael, it didn't mean they weren't blessed anymore. It just meant that they are not in the covenant vocation. And that's why they go east. So again, Abraham is partnering with God without hesitation. Now his partnership is absolute. And the last thing that we see is Genesis 24 about Abraham that Isaac gets to learn, and that is Abraham getting Isaac a wife. What it reveals here, first of all, is that again, Abraham has a great commitment to the covenant relationship. He insists on Isaac remaining in Canaan so as not to lose any grip on the land. If he leaves, he most likely will stay with his wife's family because there's no owned land to bring the wife back to. If he goes, right, that's more likely that he's going to end up staying. He also wants to make sure that the wife is from Abraham's extended family. It speaks to Abraham understanding that God has chosen Abraham's family and not another family. It is ethnic separation according to what God has chosen. God has chosen Abraham's family. It must stay that way. It's not that they are religious monotheists. They're not. They're pagans. But the covenant was given to Abraham's family, and that is where Abraham is determined it will stay. We also need to understand that intermarriage with Canaanites would risk assimilation into those people's paradigms and thus jeopardize the covenant promises of being a righteous people meant to bless others, right? If they're going to assimilate, they're not going to be a righteous people, right relationship with God, and they will not be able to be that righteous minority that blesses others, which again is to speak about impact again. Such a small family must guard against being impacted by the larger culture. One of the other things we know about the A&E culture is Aramaean women, which is where he's sending for Isaac's wife, their wives embrace the faith of their husbands. Canaanite wives actually entice the husbands to take on their religious views and their paradigms. So again, we have this idea, yes, the Arameans that he's sending to are still pagans, but the wives taken from Aramea, anywhere in Aramea, will be brought into the husband's faith. So what Abraham's doing is he's eschewing the world's ways of achieving the promise. He's not trying to get the promise furthered. He's just trying to say, God, you're enough. I know you're going to bring about what is good. Abraham cannot acquire the land by marriage partnership, which is the most common way to acquire land. He's not going to do that any more than he's going to do it through conquest, which he refused to do in rescuing Lot, or purchase, which he refused to do in the burial site. So what this does when he does then sends his servant to his brother-in-law, right? He sends him up to Nahor. This is the longest passage, right? About Isaac getting, about the servant. And it gets told twice in the same chapter. Yeah. The whole story gets told twice. Yeah. What it's doing is highlighting that God's sovereignty is over these circumstances. So let me tell you why. So what the servant uses a method, it's called an oracular method. So an oracle, he uses an oracle. And an oracle is thus, it presents a yes-no question to the deity. It says, if this happens, you're saying yes. If this happens, you're saying no. But it isn't a merely, this is what I'd like to happen. If this happens, yes. If this happens, no. What he does is he poses the possibility of an extraordinary answer of yes. So the yes has to be something out of the ordinary, out of something that would not happen. And that would actually tell us that only through God's direction will it happen. So here's what the servant does. It would be ordinary and common for a woman out at the well to offer a drink to a stranger. So the oracle can't be if she offers me a drink, because that's normal. But to offer to water camels, they can drink up to 25 gallons at a time. A watering jar holds no more than 3 gallons, which means 80 to 100 drawings of water from the well to be able to accommodate the servant's camels. Such an unbelievable proposal would indicate God is working to override human nature. That's what an oracle is. That's how the servant presents it. And then he retells the whole story again to Rebecca's family, all for the purpose of making sure that the family, as well as the reader, knows this marriage is divinely sanctioned. It could not have come about any other way. There's lots and lots and lots in this story. We're not going to go through everything because we don't have the time. But one of the other things it does is it begins to reveal the characters of the major players, right? We understand already now the character of Laban, because he's going to play a major part in Jacob's story. We already see his character. Just the fact that they introduced Laban by saying, when he saw the rings and bracelets, all goes after that. We see so much. I wish we had time to go through it. I'm going to skip all of that. We see Rebecca's character being revealed. We see her decisively say she's going to go. She recognizes that she is a pawn in her brother's schemes. She wants to go. She wants a new life. She wants an identity. She's open to a new identity, which is good. But we also have to recognize that she has been influenced her whole life by her family's ethics. Do what you need to do to get what you want. We need to know that as we go into Isaac's story. We know Laban's character. We know Rebecca's character from this, so that we understand the Lord still has a lot of work to do. Right? There's still going to be some character changes needed. It gives us the context then for the work that's going to be done in Isaac's life. And we see some of Isaac's character revealed. He was meditating in the field when they came, when Rebecca and the servant come. He brings Rebecca into his mother's tent and he's willing to receive what has been given. And we see that he loves Rebecca. So what has Isaac seen that's already molded him? He's seen provision, right? He's seen firsthand that God provides for immediate needs. He saw this through his father's own trustworthy partnerships with God and with others. We see apparently that he has some relationship with God as we see him out meditating, which is to have conversation with God. We also know that he has seen protection. All of Abraham's other sons are being sent away. So he is a recipient of all of Abraham's inheritance, even before Abraham dies. He understands that life will come to him. And he receives a compatible wife without having to travel outside the land. And even the timing of meeting Rebecca is providential. As he's out walking and there she comes. And they have, when it talks about her putting on her veil, that is the extent of their wedding ceremony. That literally says, I'm your bride, and then he takes her in.
20 seconds.
Yeah, right. So we see that he's able to wait and not take. So now we get to the opportunities for God to mold his disappointment into expectancy of good. So Genesis 25. He's going to give him his first opportunity through the family dynamics. Death, marriage, birth. So he's going to provoke Isaac's disappointment. The first place he's going to provoke Isaac's disappointment is in Sarah's death. He's been mourning his mother for 3 years. Remember, it's the mother who fought for his position, who was transformed in his birth. Why did it take 3 years for him to mourn? Why did Abraham wait until Sarah was dead before he actually went and found Isaac a wife? Was the connection between Isaac and Sarah so strong? Wouldn't Sarah have called for a marriage that she could approve? We don't know the answers to any of these. What we do know is that Isaac is not soothed from his grief of losing Sarah until he marries Rebecca. And she replaces Sarah. It says, Isaac was comforted after his mother's death by receiving Rebecca as a wife he loved. This is the first sign we have of Isaac's disordered disappointment. I know, we want to say, oh, isn't that wonderful? Rebecca's arrival replaces Sarah in Isaac's affection, and it soothes him. He loves Rebecca, it says. But the Hebrew, just like English, is very ambiguous. Hebrew is not like Greek. Greek is very specific, right? When we talk about the word love, we know exactly what we're asking because it has different words. Hebrew, like English, has one word, just love. Ahab. It can mean love for another person. It can mean sexual love, sensual love. It can mean love for food. It can mean love for an item, just like the English word. But there's a hint here about Isaac's kind of love and his character. He's still mourning for his mother. It's been 3 years. How did Abraham mourn? He mourned, and he got up, and he began to continue to move with God. He mourns and gets up back to life with God. It indicates for us that Isaac is wallowing in disappointment. He's still avoiding being hurt. And so he's looking for soothing, which is why it says Isaac was comforted by Rebecca after his mother's death. I'm sorry, but every woman here, how would you feel about a man saying, "Oh, good, you're going to replace my mother"? Right? Creepy. No, absolutely not. Isaac's love for Rebecca is one that soothes him, one that helps him avoid the disappointment of his mother's death. So the kind of love he has for Rebecca here tells us the word comfort means to soothe, to console oneself. It is a self-reflective verb here. It is to soothe oneself. It seems he sees Rebecca as a soothing tool, a replacement for Sarah. Does that seem like a trustworthy foundation for a marriage? It wasn't Abraham's intent to bring him a soothing tool. He is doing it to fulfill the covenant. It is Isaac who makes the marriage into a soothing tool. And if this disordered thinking isn't addressed, it's going to be passed down and escalated. So how is Isaac's sight? Despite all he has seen, his clarity about the unseen is very questionable. He has a disordered way of understanding God as provider. He seems to think that means he will never be in need. And he completely ignores the partnership aspect. He seems content to remain a receiver, never a partner. Noticing, has it never crossed your mind that Isaac never does anything? He is always receiving, but never partnering. We, of course, God is going to change that. So, what about God's sovereignty here? First of all, don't take this as a how-to about parenting. This is not God saying, so Sarah and Abraham did a bad job of parenting, and this is why Isaac turned out. This is what we always do, right? We always look and go, oh, well, we don't want our children to be like Isaac and being soothing. So what did Abraham and Sarah do? No, that's not what the text is about. God is merely using Isaac's disordered thinking to reveal our own disordered thinking. The purpose isn't to teach us about parenting. Despite good upbringing, there will still be disorder for God to devour. Even if you're the son of Abraham, for us, even if you're the son of Billy Graham, God had to do a lot of devouring with Franklin. In other words, we, his family, don't only struggle with fear in our self-focused lives, but also with disappointment, every one of us. God uses the patriarchs to reveal his faithful working, just as he said, and to continue to reveal himself. This time, he will reveal his sovereignty through Isaac's disordered disappointment. So, he's provoking Isaac's disappointment in Sarah's death. He will continue to provoke disappointment in Isaac through Rebecca's barrenness and through the conflicted twins. So, first of all, we see Rebecca is barren. And so, of course, disappointment, right? I want children. Is it ordered or disordered? What does Isaac do?
He prays to God.
Yay! That's exactly what it should be due, right? We're disappointed. It wasn't our picture. Oh, God, what's your picture? I will pray. I will ask you about this. I will talk to you about this. This isn't even something we saw Abraham do with Sarah, right? The text never tells us that Abraham prayed for Sarah. So we see Isaac moving toward God in his disappointment. Yay, that's exactly what we want done.
Yay.
Now the answer doesn't come for 20 years. So notice Isaac is 40 when he's married. He's 60 when the twins are born. So for 20 years, we have no answer. But the answer is, oh, they're going to have children. And so this should be great, right? Except that the text actually says, but. So we know there's a disappointment coming, right? We have, but, the twins within you. But there was disorder in Rebecca's womb. The rejoinder here is the news of Rebecca's conception, is that the children are struggling together inside her womb. Another disappointment. Why? So we go, well, wait, babies always move inside the womb. No, this is a beyond that. This is a fact that Rebecca says something is wrong here. And so disappointment creeps up again. Wait a second. We've waited 20 years. We are now pregnant, and now something is wrong with this pregnancy. The struggle makes them fear that either they will lose the pregnancy or something, or they will lose her, right? Because infant mortality, mother mortality, very large in the Middle East at that time. So they're afraid now. What?
Twins were probably not all that common.
No, exactly. And so,
again,
all this, think about the amount of movement twins make as far as,
right.
So this is beyond. So, disappointment. What, is it order disappointment or disorder disappointment?
Order.
Why?
Because she goes and prays, she inquires.
So Rebecca demonstrate ordered disappointment. Yay! She goes to the Lord and inquires, what's going on? And what does God do? He gives them a new picture. Uh-huh. The Lord reveals a different reality than they had hoped for. Two nations are in your womb, Rebecca. That means one of the children will not be under the family and the covenant. Two nations implies two separate families. One people will be stronger, the Lord tells her, and the older will serve the younger. So before the children are born, both Isaac and Rebekah know that Esau will serve Jacob. That's the Lord's picture. And it's not the picture either Rebekah or Isaac had. So now they're doubly disappointed. They couldn't be pregnant. Now they're pregnant. There's a problem with the pregnancy. And now we're being told the picture is one of those sons is going off and not being part. It's going to be two nations within your womb. But the picture is what God has for them. This is the picture. It's an opportunity, again, to move toward God, to receive this new picture as his good.
Why would they be disappointed if one is in the covenant, one is not, when Isaac knew he was in the covenant and all his other brothers were sent? You know.
Right. But, of course, when you're painting your own picture and your own children, all of a sudden, so... Why would Isaac be disappointed? Why would any parent be disappointed? One of your children will be a covenant blessing bearer. The other child will be sent away. There will be a different, it will not be part of your family.
Yeah.
That would be very disappointing to any parent, right?
Well, remember how Abram wanted
right.
Ishmael to
exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. Abram had to be molded to a point where he could give his sons away, right? But he didn't want to give Ishmael away. Isaac doesn't either.
But think about it.
Nor does Rebecca.
Give one of your kids away?
No.
Somebody said.
No, exactly. Only you can only keep one. The other has to go away. So yes, there's great disappointment, and it's not their picture. It wouldn't be any of our pictures either. Remember again, always, we cannot paint the picture of what is good because we don't know everything. We think so. We think this is good, but it's not. So what is their response to the new picture? They revert to self-soothing. Apparently, the children themselves become each parent's self-soothing apparatus. Mm. To take away the emotional pain of the loss of their picture, they attach themselves to the boys according to what makes them most comfortable.
Uh-huh.
Rather than attaching themselves to God and to one another, partnering with him with his picture, right? Abraham was able to keep Ishmael for 13 years until he was a man. They could have partnered with God at this point. Okay, We're going to keep Esau around until he's a man, and then we're going to provide him with gifts and send him off. Neither wants to do that, and so they attach themselves each to one of the sons. Isaac, it says, loves Esau. Notice how many times the word love is used here in Isaac's story, because it's all what Isaac does. Isaac loves Esau, and it says he loved Esau because he loved the taste of game, and Esau was a hunter. Esau could get him the thing that could soothe his desires. Rebekah loves Jacob, who was, it says, a peaceful man. The word peaceful actually means complete or socially acceptable. He was a gentleman. So Esau was a man's man. Jacob was a lady's man. That's what we have here, is these two people. And Isaac and Rebekah both begin to attach themselves to the boys as their soothing methods. And what happens then is they move away from partnering. When they choose to move towards soothing themselves, anytime we move towards soothing ourselves, we will move away from partnering. Move away from partnering with God's good picture, and move away from each other. Right? Because they're attaching themselves to their sons. Their subsequent favoritism then exacerbates the tension, which will, in God's sovereignty, actually eventually lead to accomplishing God's picture. But let's talk about, then it goes immediately to the birthright transaction, where Esau sells his birthright. So we have the sons who are now adults at this point. And this birthright transaction actually reveals their character. It reveals not only their character, but the disorders that will need to be eventually addressed. The selling of one's birthright would have appalled the first readers. They would have read that and gone, are you kidding me? It doesn't matter what the reason is. It says here that Esau was famished. Is that true? Is that just how Esau feels? Like our kids come in and say, I'm starving. Or was he really starving? He was maybe hunting for days and not eating anything. It actually doesn't matter. Because for the first readers, they would say, there isn't anything that would make you sell your birthright. It gives us the opportunity not only to see their character, but also what they value. And of course, what they value always has to do with their character. So we see Jacob desires the birthright. He values the future prosperity, deferred prosperity, rather than immediate gratification. He's willing to wait because he knows he puts more value in what is to come. Esau, on the other hand, despises his birthright. He considers future promises as of little value. Material, immediate value is the only important thing for him. It says he despises. It means to hold in contempt, to not give it the respect that it's due. He cares only for what will fill him now, not for what will shape him over time. And so we have the values shown of both boys. The birthright is about material possession, about getting a double portion, but it infers a privileged status, a right of succession, to be the next patriarch. Now, Jacob does take advantage of Esau's lack of faith here. So God's giving the grace in assigning Jacob as the one who will carry the covenant on, as the role of the blessing bearer, is not a reward for Jacob's good behavior, nor of his motivation. It's not a reward, it's a gift. It's the gift that he gives Jacob that will be the source of the changing of Jacob's character. It's not because Jacob deserved it, although he does value what God values. It is the gift that will actually change that value to a character of God's. So that's as much as I can say about that. Let's go on to Genesis 26. And so we have a familiar story. Now it came about, there was a famine in the land, beside the previous famine. So it makes sure you understand, and one of the reasons it does this is because some theologians, whenever they see a story that looks exactly like another story, they say, oh, they're just retelling that story and putting it on another character. The writer of the story makes sure you know, this is not the same. It looks exactly the same, but it's not the same. And anytime there are two stories that look very similar, what we're supposed to be drawn to is not the similarities, but the differences. And so let's look at the differences here in the famine that Isaac participates in. So we have God telling him, look, yes, there's a famine. Isaac, stay here in the land. So that's one difference, right? Abraham wasn't told. He was just should have known that. Isaac is told, stay in the land. And Isaac does. He honors the Lord. He hears the Lord. Great. He stays in the land. And in that, now God actually gives him the covenant. So remember, the covenant really can't be passed down. God has to give it. So he gives it to Isaac. So remember, the patriarchs are the foundation of the covenant. He gives it to Abraham. Now God gives it to Isaac. And in the covenant giving, he assures him of his presence and his blessings. He says, I'm going to give you the land. I'm going to give you descendants. I'm going to give you a vacation. So there's no reason for you to be afraid or disappointed. And yet, Isaac is provoked to lie. The same exact lie that Abraham had practiced, right? So obviously the practice had been carried down. But why? Why does he lie? Where's the disappointment here? He says, even to himself, that it's because of the fear of death. He's quoting, basically, Abraham. But his words actually tell us that he's protecting himself from disappointment of not having access to Rebekah's beauty. Now, let's contrast Abraham's situation. Abraham says that Sarah is beautiful, but he shares that with Sarah. So he said, Abraham says to Sarah, Sarah, you are beautiful. And the word used here for beautiful is handsome. It's, yes, you are a beautiful human being. He shares that. And then he says, and the men would kill me because you are my wife. Now, let's look at Isaac. Isaac, does Isaac tell Rebekah she's beautiful?
No,
he thinks to himself, she's beautiful. And the word he uses is not the same word he uses for Abraham. The beauty he's talking about means agreeable to the senses, valuable for satisfying my senses. Oh, do you see the difference? Sarah, you're a beautiful, God has made you beautiful. Isaac, ooh, you're beautiful. That kind of beautiful, that sensual, that could do something for me.
And he's still seeing her as a soothing tool.
Yes, he is. And you're going to see that even more strongly. And so he says to himself, she's beautiful. Our term would be hot, right? That's the term that he's using here. And they will kill me because she is, what did Abraham say? Because she's my wife. That's Abraham sees Sarah's wife. What does Isaac see? Rebekah. Because she's hot. Because she's beautiful. Not because she's my wife. Do you see the very subtle differences here? How Isaac is looking at this? His actions reveal that Rebekah's beauty, her sensual beauty, is what soothes him. So, context. Abraham does what he does. He lies immediately because Pharaoh wants to take Sarah into her court. And Sarah's taken immediately into Pharaoh's court. Notice I'm trying to find the verse where it says, Isaac was in the place, was in there for a long time.
Verse 8.
And it came about when he had been there a long time. So we have Isaac lying, and then he lives there for a long time, and he's continuing the ruse. Right? He's continuing to say this. And yet, it says that the king actually sees Isaac. What does it say in your Bible? What's the word? term.
Looked down from a window and saw Isaac caressing his wife.
It saw Isaac caressing his wife. Now, here's a funny thing. The word there is actually the same word that has been used throughout for Isaac. What's the big word for Isaac all the time from before Isaac was born to after? What does Isaac mean?
What's what?
What does Isaac mean? What does the word Isaac mean?
Laughter.
Laughter. That's the word here. It's laughter. But what it means, the connotation here, is playing, sexual playing. So caressing is actually a pretty good translation for that, but it's this sexual play is what it is. That's exactly what's happening here. And so...
What you wouldn't be doing with your sister.
What you wouldn't be doing with your sister, right? Exactly. It is not just, oh, Sarah, you're beautiful. It is actually going toward sexual gratification. If he's really afraid for his life, and says Rebecca's his sister, he would not engage in risky behavior that would say otherwise. Right? And his caressing is in public space. What this is telling you is that his overwhelming attraction to Rebecca's sensual beauty is his self-soothing tool, and that overwhelms any fear. So even Isaac can't be honest about, it's not really about fear, about me dying, it's really, I don't want to be disappointed and lose this self-soothing tool. That's what's happening with Isaac. And yet it's all done in the face of God's reiterated covenant. Isaac is more drawn to satisfying his sensual desires than God's picture. I'm going to give you a land and descendants and a vocation. And yet Isaac wants to continually be soothed. So we see God, we see Isaac moving away from God's picture of partnership. He instills distrust among Abraham's former partners. Abimelech is really angry. He says, "You have put my people in harm's way. What would have happened if someone would have come with this? All this time you've been here and you've continued to allow this lie to lay there." And Abimelech charges his people, "Don't even touch these people." This is not so much a protection for them. It is saying, move away from them. They are not reliable. They are not trustworthy. It is, they are not good partners. And so, everyone is supposed to move away from them. And yet, we see God continuing to bless Isaac. But now his blessings can't be shared with others because they have moved away. It gives further reason, his blessing without being able to share, gives further reason for Abimelech's people to feel disconnected, right? There's no close contact, so they can't see that God is actually working in Isaac's life. And Isaac is now not sharing his wealth, nor even, "I'll pray to the Lord for you, for your crops to be better," or explain that "my crops are good because my God is so good." None of that can happen because now there's been a move away from partnership. So the Philistines are provoked to jealousy, and they oppress Isaac by stopping the wells. And then there's all these arguments, right, with the wells. And finally, Abimelech says, "Go away. It's not just my people that are going to leave you alone. Now you just go away. You are absolutely an untrustworthy partner. Go away." And so he sends Isaac away, and there's these times of he digs a well, and it still happens, so he has to go farther. Digs another well, it happens, and he has to go farther. And he has to go to a point where they're so far away that there is no conflict. So Isaac's attachment to his self-soothing tools and schemes destroys partnership. That's what psychologists tell us happens with self-soothing schemes. It always destroys relationships. It eliminates space where God can be revealed. And yet we have God reminding again, putting up there, "Isaac, here's my picture." Notice God doesn't change his picture for Isaac. Isaac must move toward God once again. And so we have all that pushing away. Isaac ends up going back to Beersheba. And it says, Isaac went up. And remember, directions in Genesis are a big deal. Isaac goes up to Beersheba. Beersheba is where Abraham lived and where he returned after the sacrifice of Isaac. So Isaac knows this place. It's the beginning for Isaac. Isaac's going back to the beginning. We saw that with Abraham, remember? We'll see it with Jacob, and we see it here with Isaac. It indicates a return to Abraham's ways. Oh, wait, God is the one who provides. Let's see if we can start again. And the Lord then continues to bless Isaac, not because of his own faithfulness, but because of the faithfulness to the covenant to Abraham. And now we have Isaac building an altar, calling on the Lord. Yes, it's good to be back at the beginning where I'm looking at the Lord. And so now Abimelech asks for a covenant. Now Abimelech says, okay, I can see that the Lord continues to bless you. I would like to be in partnership with you, not because you're trustworthy, but because your God is trustworthy. So, Genesis 27. I know I'm really zipping through this, but we need to finish Isaac today. Rushing the blessing. So, again, God is going to work in the same way. He's going to provoke disappointment in Isaac. He's going to do it two ways. First of all, at the end of 26, it tells us about Esau. When Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith, the daughter of a Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of a Hittite. So, and it says it brings grief to Isaac and Rebekah. Bitterness of spirit, disappointment. And then we have a second disappointment. Now, it came about when Isaac was old and his eyes were too dim to see. So we have disappointment in our son's choice of wives, and we have disappointment in blindness, in our physical ailment. Blindness is a circumstance that is not in Isaac's control, and it disappoints him enough that he considers that this deterioration is really just leading him to death. There's no indication of impending death here. He actually lives many, many, many more years. He lives 10 years after Joseph is taken as a slave. His son Jacob isn't even married yet, let alone having his 11th son. Isaac, though, considers blindness such a disappointment that this must be death. That's what he's implying. Woe is me. I'm dying because I'm losing my sight. But of course, the author uses eyes too dim to see as a highlight for his spiritual condition. He still doesn't see that God's picture is the good reality. So combined with his disappointment over Esau's marrying outside the family, Isaac is once again wanting to be soothed. So his response to his disappointment, he intends to bless Esau now. Esau's his favorite. Now, by custom, he's the oldest, and he should receive the first blessing. But let's talk about blessing again in the A&E context. Blessing is always a celebratory occasion, which is why Isaac actually wants a feast. But blessing always involves the whole family. All the family are gathered together, and all of the sons get a blessing. We'll see that as we see Jacob blessing his sons. It's a patriarchal blessing. It's not the covenant blessing. He can't give that. A patriarchal blessing represents the hopes and wishes of the father for the sons. In other words, it's the picture he's painting. There's no prophetic power behind a patriarchal blessing. God isn't obligated to fulfill that blessing. But there is an expectation because it's the father's painting of what he thinks should happen. And it always was expected that the blessing would indicate the destiny of the boys. The power of the blessing is in its being spoken. Just like in creation, once it's spoken, it is the truth. It is what order has been set up. It's permanent. But here, Esau treats the blessing as a transaction. He's basically saying, oh, I really need to be soothed. Esau, go hunt and fix me stew so I feel good, and then I can bless you. A complete transaction. He's completely turning the blessing into a transaction so that he can be soothed.
Is it typically done at the time of the father's passing? Like, is there a time in which it would have happened?
It would, yes. It would technically be done somewhere toward the end of when either the boys are going off or he's dying. At this point, although Esau has gone and married, Jacob is not married yet. Jacob's a lot older than we begin to think sometimes. But his intention also is to hide the blessing from the rest of the family. Why? Because his hopes and his expectations, his painting, conflicts with God's picture. And Rebecca knows God's picture. Right? He wants to keep his picture because it affords him the opportunity for self-soothing. Self-soothing is most often done in secret. Think about your own self-soothing. Right? You do it in secret. Why? Because if it's out in the open, somebody's going to call it out. Somebody's going to say, are you self-soothing? Are you just trying to avoid going to God with this disappointment? It's going to be need to be addressed. So it'll be mostly in secret. Esau has already demonstrated that he doesn't value the birthright, which the blessing would come through. Is Isaac hoping to change the character of Esau at this time? Or does he intend to send Esau away because of the pagan wives and preparing him to give a gift of blessing? Well, we don't know, but whatever the reason, it's not to fulfill God's picture. Because he's giving the entire blessing to Esau and not Jacob. But God is going to remind him of what the picture is, and he's going to do it in an unexpected way. He's going to do it through Rebecca's scheme. So here's how we know. Remember what I told you about an oracle? That the most unexpected thing, if that happens, it tells us God is involved here. All right, so let's look at the scheme Rebecca has. The scheme is very unlikely going to succeed. Isaac is blind. My grandfather was blind. I did a science experiment that I went to state with, because what happens anytime you lose one sense, all the rest of your other senses are heightened. So a blind person's sense of feel, sense of taste, sense of hearing are all better than anybody else's. So all of this, all of his senses are heightened, but this is Rebecca's scheme. She wants to make goat taste like venison. She wants to make goat skin feel like human skin. She wants to make Jacob's voice sound like Esau. If all of his senses are heightened, what it's telling us is that Isaac's common sense is dulled by the desire for soothing. That is ruling him. That is what has his attention. He wants so badly to have his picture accomplished that it skews reality. Rebecca has her own blindness. She takes the possible curse on herself. In other words, she'll do anything to satisfy her picture, even the loss of her husband, because that's what the curse would be, right? Go away from me. But a blessing is never transferable, so neither is a curse. So she actually hones into Jacob's desires for this blessing and his blindness to reality. She has a blind. She can't take on the curse. She thinks she can, but she can't. And she tells Jacob she can because he's blind as well. Oh, I won't have to pay for this. And yet, it succeeds. Well, it tells us two things. It tells us something about Isaac and tells us something about God. First of all, it tells us that this is God's picture. He wants Jacob to be blessed. But what does it tell us about Isaac? Well, Isaac tested Jacob. He tested him through logic, through touch, through voice, through word, through scent. And the one deception that fails is Jacob's voice. He lets all the others slide, and then he says, but it doesn't sound like Esau. And yet he ignores that, which is the whole idea here for the author, is to remind us, wait a second, where else have we heard someone hearing another voice and they go toward that voice that's not telling them reality? Oh, all the way back to Genesis 3. We see him listening to a voice that is giving him the desires of his sensual, soothing needs rather than the voice of God. We will go along with voices that call us to acquire what we want, satisfaction of our desires. It tells us, though, that despite the whole disorder of the whole situation, God's picture is sovereignly being presented. Well, I want Jacob to be blessed. And if I have to use the disorder of my people, I will. And we'll affirm that later on. So, what's the response to the new picture? Isaac is angry. It says he trembles violently. He is offended. How do we know he's offended? Because he blames Jacob for it, which is pretty interesting. He says, he deceived me. He has taken the blessing. In truth, Isaac was deceived by his own desires. And he gave the blessing to Jacob. Jacob didn't take it. What's Esau's response? Same thing, anger. And he says, Jacob is rightly named. He basically calls Jacob a name. He's blaming Jacob for taking his birthright. Jacob didn't take the birthright. Esau sold it. And for taking the blessing. And again, he didn't take it. Isaac gave it to him. And Esau goes into crying. He is a grown man. And he's crying, I want the blessing, I want the blessing. All I could think of was the Willy Wonka, I want it now! That's all I could think of Esau Baraga. Sitting there. Baraga, I want it now, Daddy, I want it now! That's exactly what Esau is doing here. And so Jacob is desperate. Here's my soothing tool. I've got to help him. I need to give him a blessing. But his blessing can't be reversed. And he's desperate. But he has little to offer. Why? He gave all of his blessing to Jacob. He meant to give it all to Esau, which would have been wrong also. You're not supposed to give all the blessing to one son. You're supposed to give blessings all along, right? He doesn't have anything to give. And so what he does is he takes Jacob's blessing and he just says, you can have the reverse of it. And the reverse of Jacob's blessing, Jacob is to receive abundance from heaven's dew and from the earth's richness. And Esau is going to dwell away from heaven's dew and away from earth's richness. But then he gives him one thing he can give him. The second part of Esau's blessing offers relief. He says, eventually you will be able to break from under Jacob and you will have your own nation apart from my line, apart from Abraham's line. Which actually is all Esau cares about. Is demonstrated by his contempt for the birthright and the covenant family line. He doesn't really care. He just wants what I want now. God's picture, though, although it's been revealed in a disordered way, it's at risk, right? Because despite the success of Rebekah's plan, there's now more tension and more conflict, so much so that Jacob is in danger of being killed by his brother Esau. So it exposes untrustworthy relationships between husband and wife and between brothers. But also, now there's separation. Jacob must leave. So Rebecca, although she didn't get the curse, she does get consequences. And that is her soothing tool, her son Jacob, has to leave. She's assuming it's going to be a short time. It's going to be 20 years. So there's an emotional separation for Rebecca and Jacob, but also between Rebecca and Isaac. How do you think Rebecca and Isaac are going to get along now? Mm-hmm. And Rebecca and Esau. Goodness. Yes. And so the last opportunity we have is Esau's grudge. Genesis 27 into 28. Provoking disappointment. Rebecca's plan to protect Jacob is to make it about the disappointment with Esau. I want to protect Jacob, so I'll provoke Isaac's disappointment over Esau. That's how I'll get my way. So it's Rebecca who provokes the disappointment. And yet, we finally have Isaac embracing God's picture. Yes, the family conflict has escalated. Isaac's picture is completely shattered. But now Isaac moves toward God as we go into 28. So Isaac called Jacob and blessed him. Oh, wait, he's already blessed him. Yes, this time it is in full sight. Isaac's eyesight is being restored. He moves toward God by blessing Jacob of his own accord. I know who you are, and I also know God's picture, and I'm going to move toward that. And he charges Jacob to find a wife among his family. He's going with God's picture, the covenant picture. And then he asks God Almighty. This is how we understand that Isaac knows, God, you are sovereign. And anytime we talk about sovereign, it is God paints the picture of reality, and it's a good picture. God Almighty, I know you are sovereign. I know the picture you paint is the only reality. And he says to God Almighty, would you extend the blessing, the covenant blessing, to Jacob? Basically, he's saying, I'm not going to interfere here. This is your picture. I'm all in. Yes, would you do this? It is a request to come back into partnership with God. Isaac has finally recognized that in God's sovereignty, he can let go of his own picture, which will relieve him of the need to self-soothe, and he'll be able to bless Jacob and send him off publicly. Esau, of course, moves away. He's still trying to soothe himself that he's the favorite son by pleasing his father. Yet his blindness leads him to marry a daughter of Ishmael, completely oblivious of the covenant's parameters. Stay within the family, the Abrahamic family, not the Ishmael family that's already been sent away. And Jacob now begins his journey, which is where we'll take up next week. So, summary, really quick. God will provoke our disappointments in order to expose our disordered thinking about God as provider. And he will expose the emptiness of our own pictures. We don't see and know everything. We can't possibly make a picture that will be a picture of what is good. We can't rely on our picture as the standard. Yes, we're all going to come up with pictures, but we can't use them as, oh, let's set that on the mantle. That's the standard, that's where we're going by. And also to expose the destructiveness of our self-soothing techniques in order to open up our eyes to his picture. His sovereignty always paints a picture of what is good. He's not going to give us all the details about the picture. When I was young, I don't know for some of you that are as old as I am or older, the big thing in church, particularly at night services, were chalk artists. Anybody remember the chalk artists? So chalk artists would start with a black canvas, and they would begin telling a biblical story. And as the whole time they were, and you're like, this is nothing. This is just red marks and blue marks. And every time it looked like nothing. But at the end, it would reveal this absolutely amazing picture, and you just sit there. Oh my goodness, it's a picture of what he's been talking about. That's the idea. God doesn't give us all the details at once, but he gives us enough to move us forward in assurance that, yes, I'm doing is good. The picture I'm painting is good. So that our disappointment can be turned into expectancy of good. I am always painting a picture of good. That's the story of Isaac. So, may the God of peace equip you to do every good thing according to his will, working in us that which is pleasing to him through Jesus Christ, to whom be the glory forever and ever. Amen.